This is Sarah Milligan with the Kentucky Oral History Commission. I'm here in Mount Sterling, Kentucky. It's February 23rd, 2008. I'm doing World War II interviews, and right now I'm interviewing Raymond Turley. Sorry, I lost my list. Oh, there it is. Raymond Turley, who was in the Army Air Corps, correct? World War II.
United States Army Air Corps.
So, tell me how what started your World War II experience?
Well, in September the 21st, I was 20 years old, and I knew that I would soon be drafted, and I didn't know where they would send me, what branch of the service, but I wanted to be an aircraft mechanic. So I had my dad to take me over to Lexington to the recruiting officer, and I told him that I wanted to enlist for 3 years and I wanted to be an airplane mechanic. So he asked me several questions and he weighed me and he said you only weigh 113 pounds, and he said you're supposed to weigh 117 pounds in order to enlist in the Army. And I said, I sure would love to be an airplane mechanic. I said, I'm tired of following them old mules on the farm, and I'd like to get away from following them, be an airplane mechanic. So he said, well, he said, you'll probably gain a few pounds. So he wrote down, he said, you're supposed to be at least 117 pounds. So he wrote down 117 pounds and enlisted me in the service. And that was in the afternoon, my dad went back to Mount Sterling, back to Winchester, and they sent me up to Fort Thomas, and there they gave me my shots and gave me a thorough examination, and there were some more fellows with us, and they took us over to the Cincinnati train depot and put us on a train, and we rode all night to Fort Slocum, New York, or New York train station there, and they took us from the train station over to Fort, and we stayed there for several days, and then when they got enough for a shipload of Army personnel, they put us on a ship, and we sailed down the East Coast down to the Panama Canal. And I thought the Panama Canal ran east and west, but when we got down to Panama Canal, it runs north and south. So Balboa is on one side and Cristobal is on the other side. And I've forgotten which is which, but anyhow, we was going through the Panama Canal, and we were up on the deck of the ship, and there was a rainbow, and we all got in the end of the rainbow, but there wasn't a pot of gold there. So we went on through the Panama Canal and sailed up the East Coast to San Francisco, and we got off the ship there, and they took us over to Angel Island while they refueled the ship and put on new supplies. While we was on Angel Island, they gave us a pass to go to San Francisco. So when we were coming back from San Francisco, they stopped at Alcatraz, Isle of Alcatraz. And the fellow that was running that small ship, he said, now if y'all want to say you've been on Alcatraz, he said, step out on the deck and then get back on the ship, and then we'll take you on over to Angel Island. And you say, I've been on the Isle of Alcatraz. So we got we did that, and then they as soon as they got the ship loaded and ready to go, about 4 o'clock one afternoon, they headed out for Hawaii, went under the Golden Gate Bridge, and just before dark, they came around and they started posting guards on the ship from the front of the ship to the back, and they put me right on the back of the ship. And about 11 o'clock that night, they told me to stay there on guard, and they said, if you see anybody overboard or anything unusual, said you come over and pick this phone up and holler, man overboard, man overboard. And said, you stay here until you're relieved. We'll bring a guard around to relieve you. Well, this storm came up, and it kept getting worse and worse. I noticed the front of the ship, it got to where it was dipping in the water. But I didn't see anybody on the deck of the ship. But the storm kept getting worse and worse. It got to where the front of the ship would go under the water, and then the back of the ship would come out of the water. And of course, when the front of the ship came up, the water would just pour off the sides of the ship. Well, they took everybody off of the deck of the ship but me, and they forgot me back there on the back of the ship. But the way the ship was made, the water couldn't get to me. About 4 o'clock in the morning, the storm began to quieten down. We got pretty quiet then. Then they came around and started posting more guards. When the officer came around and opened the door where you go down to the lower deck, the officer came up with a guard, and I stood at attention. And the officer stood there and looked at me for a while, and finally he said, "What are you doing on this ship?" And I said, "Sir, I was posted here on guard last night and told not to leave my post till somebody relieved me." He said, "Wasn't nobody supposed to be on this deck of this ship last night in that terrible storm?" He said, "Come with me." He said, "You won't have to worry about anything between here and Hawaii." So they took me down to the mess hall, and they had metal tables. The table that I was sitting at was right close to the side of the ship. So he said, told the cooks, he said, "Bring this boy a cup of coffee." So they brought me a cup of coffee, and I was kind of sleepy and groggy, and I was about, well, they set it up on the table. At about that time, the ship rocked to one side, and the cup of coffee slid off and hit the side of the ship and broke it and run down the side of the ship. He said, "Go get this boy another cup of coffee." Well, when they brought that cup of coffee, I had both hands there to catch it. But anyway, after that, I didn't have any more guard duty or anything from there to Hawaii. When we left.
What year was this?
San Francisco. That was the 7th day of December 1940 when we set sail for Hawaii from San Francisco. On the way to Hawaii, seemed like it was calm. We never got into any more storms. And of course, it seemed like the closer we got to Hawaii, the warmer it got. And one night, where we slept, there was three bunks high. And they had got in a habit of opening the portholes. So it was so hot in the where we were sleeping. And one night, about 2 o'clock in the morning, a flying fish came through one of those portholes and got in the bunk with the fella just above me. And he started screaming and hollering. And he woke up everybody in there. And they come to see what was wrong with him. And that flying fish had got in around his ribs here and scratched him up, and he was bleeding. So they took him and cleaned him up and put bandage on him. And next morning when we looked at the bulletin board, it said, no more portholes will be left open between here and Hawaii. So we docked at Pearl Harbor on the 18th of December 1940. And they took us by narrow gauge railroad from Honolulu to Wheeler Field. That's where the fighter planes were. They had their fighter plane. And while at Wheeler Field, and Schofield Barracks, they just joined. Wheeler Field is south of, on the south side, and Schofield Barracks on the north side, but they just joined. And while at Wheeler Field, I got my basic training. They sent a sergeant from Schofield Barracks down at Wheeler Field, and we got our basic training there on the airfield. And I worked on P-26s and P-40 fighter planes. And
what did you think when you got to Hawaii? When you stepped off the ship and saw where you were?
I thought, what a beautiful place. I thought I've never seen such a beautiful place in all my life. And I worked on P-40s and P-26s until December the 7th. And on the week before December the 7th, we were put on maneuvers around Wheeler Field. And we had pillboxes made. They brought a machine gunner down from Schofield Barracks.
Is this in 1941?
This was a week before December the 7th in 1941. Mm-hmm. And we had a rifle and a belt of ammunition and steel helmet and a gas mask. And we were out there day and night, and they brought our meals around to us, and we stayed there. And they took the fighter planes and had revetments made. They were made like a big horseshoe. And each one of these fighter planes was back, each revetment faced a different direction. And then they had these P-40 fighter planes backed in there, and they were had loaded with ammunition and fuel, and the pilot was with them. And we were supposed to be out there for 1 week. And that was on Monday morning when we started our maneuvers. And machine gunner from Schofield Barracks, he showed us how to feed the ammunition to him if he had to use the machine gun. Each day he'd tell us something, usually a little different or something, how to help him in case we had attacked, you know. And we were out there from Monday until about 4 o'clock on Friday afternoon. Then the engineering officer came around, and he said, maneuvers has been called off. He said, you fellas from Schofield Barracks, you take your machine gun back to Schofield Barracks. And he said, you other fellas to take your guns and your ammunition and your steel helmet and your gas mask and turn them in. And said, then you'll go get you a pass and go to Honolulu for the weekend. So there were so many of them going that there was three of us. We decided that we weren't going. We were going to wait till Sunday morning. And we were going early Sunday morning. And we had a little thing going that whoever woke up the other two fellows, we were going to get up early and eat breakfast and get our pass and go to Honolulu for the day. And we had a little deal going that whoever woke, the one that woke up the other two, was going to get a steak dinner in Honolulu and all the Coca-Cola we could drink. We didn't drink any beer, neither one of us three. So we drank Coca-Cola. So I went around and woke them up. Of course, I was raised on the farm. I used to get up at 4 o'clock in the morning. That didn't bother me one bit. So I woke them up, and we went down to the mess hall. And I thought, oh, I'm going to get me a good steak dinner in Honolulu today. So we just sat down to eat. And we just ate a few bites, and we heard a plane come in a dive. And on Sunday mornings, real often, the Navy would come up, and they would assimilate attack on Wheeler Field. And we'd hear them come in a dive, and then hear another plane would come in to dive. And this morning, we heard this plane come in a dive, and then we heard an explosion. And we yelled, oh, the Navy's cracked up. We thought one of the Navy planes had crashed into one of the hangars or something, or the ground. But anyhow, we ran to the windows, and it so happened they were bombing from the west to the east, and we were over on the east side of the hangar line, and there was windows in the west side of this mess hall where we were eating, and we ran and looked out these windows, and we saw another plane come in a dive, and it dropped a bomb. And when it peeled up, when it turned up, and we saw the rising sun on the wings of it, and we yelled, the Japanese are bombers, Japanese bombers, let's get out of this mess hall. So we ran out of the mess hall, and I ran up towards headquarters building. I don't know where those other two fellows went to. We all separated because we didn't want to stay together. Figured one got killed, we'd all get killed. So we all separated, and I was running from the headquarters building, and they had a high curb there, a concrete curb, and there was a big tall fellow came right there with me, and he said, lay down next to that curb. And I laid down next to the curb, and these planes come over strafing. And when the planes went by, well, he said, jump up and run. So we ran to the east of the hangar line because they were bombing from the west to the east. And we ran over just a little knoll where they're building some temporary barracks out of wood. And they dug a ditch to lay a water line in. And we saw the where they had these two rows of P-40s lined up on the east side of the hangars. We saw these two Japanese planes that came in, and the pilot was down real low. I'd say he wasn't over 100 feet from the in the air, because the trees there are tropical, and they're real low. And when the pilot came in and fired through one row of them, then he mushed the plane out, and he had a gunner behind him that shot back through that same row of planes. And then the next Japanese plane came in, and he did the same thing. The pilot shot right through that row of planes, and then he mushed that plane out, and the gunner behind him shot back through those planes, and they just, of course, they was loaded with ammunition and aviation fuel, and they just melted down with fervent heat. And we were standing there with this temporary barracks, and all of a sudden something said, zing, splat, went into the side of this building, and he said, jump in that ditch. So we jumped in that ditch and laid in that ditch till the bombing and the strafing let up. And then we got up out of that ditch and walked up in front of headquarters building, and I went back down to where my barracks was, near the hangar line. And I felt like this was a guardian angel watching over me, because neither one of us got a bullet or a piece of shrapnel or anything. And after the Japanese had destroyed everything we had there at Wheeler Field, all the planes and the hangars, that we at night they had us going down to Wayan Air Depot, and we were assembling P-40s, and we stayed there at Wheeler Field for I guess 4 or 5 months. And they went up on the north end of Wahoo, at Kahuka Point. That's the most northern part of the island, was Kahuka Point. And they built a runway from one side of the island to the other. And we had the P-40s up there for a month or two. And then they brought over some B-24s, four-engine Liberator bombers. And I was in maintenance, of course, and they assigned me maintenance crew chief, and they gave me 4 maintenance men to help me with that big 4-engine bomber. And I thought, Lord, what am I going to do? Somebody been telling me what to do all this time. Now here they put me in charge of this big airplane and 4 men. And I thought, well, Lord, it's 4 engines, so I'll sign each man to an engine, and then I'll take the rest of the plane myself. So that's what I did. I signed each man to an engine, and each fella had a toolbox. So I said, now, boys, this plane has to be inspected every day, whether it flies or don't fly. Especially if it does fly. We got to check it over real good if it flies. And I said, let's pull our inspection. Everything on this plane has to be inspected every day. So I took my toolbox and I went inside the plane, and I was gone, I guess, for a couple of hours or so, and came back out with my toolbox. And these fellas, they were lined up in this big revetment that we had the planes backed into, and they were sitting over there talking, and we talked a little while, and then one of the fellas called, I believe his name was O'Leary, called me over to one side, and he said, Turley, he said, Moody didn't pull his inspection on engine number 4, said, what are you going to do? I said, Lord, I don't know what I'm going to do. So I said, well, it has to be done. I said, I'll do it myself. So I got my toolbox and my ladders, and I got up and took all the cowling off of that engine, and I pulled the inspection myself and buckled the cowling back up on it, took my toolbox and went over and sat down and talked to the boys. And the next morning when we came back, at night they had a guard that guarded the plane while we were sleeping. And next morning when I came back down, Moody said, what do you want me to do? I said, well, number 4 engine. I said, that's your baby. You got to take care of number 4 engine. And he said, but when we were in the States, we had 2 men to engine, and said they had 3 men for the rest of the plane. But I said, but we're not in the States. We're fighting the Japanese. And I said, this is all we've got. And we've got 5 men, and that's all we've got. So he said, well, okay. So he took care of number 4 engine from then on. But he was really an asset to the crew, because those 4 men had been through AM school, airplane maintenance. And I hadn't been. I'd just been working on the line. I'd actually been working on the planes myself. Mm-hmm. But he was really an asset to the crew, because he remembered just about everything that he'd he had read in the books. And lots of times we'd ask him, Moody, what's the torque on this nut? When we had to check the nuts and different things on the plane, we would every one of us, we'd ask him, say, Moody, what's the torque on this? He'd say, well, that's 40. Maybe this would be 80. This would be 60 or whatever. And we left Wahoo and went down to Johnson Island, and all the P-40s, I mean the B-24s we had, we went down to Johnson Island, and the runway run from one side of the island to the other. We landed there about 4 o'clock in the afternoon with all these planes, had them lined up along the side of the runway, and O'Leary and I were in the plane just goofing around. We wasn't doing much, just looking around, talking, and it's almost dark. And the engineering officer came by in a Jeep, and he hollered, and we answered him back, and he said, boys, get out of here. He said, go in where the coconut trees are or something. Get away from this hangar line. Do anything, get away. He said, the Japanese are going to bomb us. So we got out of that plane. We headed back into the coconut trees, and it was almost dark, and we got separated. And we were running trying to get away as far away from the hangar line as we could before they started dropping the bombs. And I was running, and something tripped me, and I fell in a hole on my face, and a bomb landed on each side of me, and I could make out, it was almost dark, but I could make out that there was some kind of an old building there. I come find out it was an old church building there that had been vacated. And the next morning I went up to see where I'd failed, and it was an old well. And they had filled this old well up almost full with just about everything. And I looked around that old well, and I couldn't find anything around that well to trip me and throw me in it. And I thought, well, I guess the good Lord just tripped me and threw me in this well so I wouldn't get a bomb or get killed. Well, anyhow.
That well saved your life then.
That was another time. The Lord took care of it.
The first man, whenever, when you were talking about the man who was telling you to get down by the curb and that was running with you, did you know him?
No, I didn't know him. I'd been there, been there almost a year. December the 18th, 1940, mm-hmm. was when I got there. And this was December the 7th, 1941, when the attack happened. Well, I'd been there that long, and I had never seen him before. And then I was there, I guess 3 or 4 months, or maybe longer than that, and I'd never seen him again.
You never saw him again?
Never saw that man again. And I felt like he was a guardian angel watching over me. But we left... When we went into the Gilbert Islands, I don't remember whether it was Gilbert or Marshall, but anyhow, we moved to another island the next day from Johnson Island.
After you fell in the well, the next day you fell in the well? The next day after you fell in the well, you moved to those islands?
That next day. I went up there real early in the morning to see. I got real early, but even before breakfast, I went to see where, and of course we left out about noon that day. Flew up to another island, and the runway run from one side of the island to the other. And while we was in the Gilbert Islands and Marshall Island, every island we was on, the runway run from one side of the island to the other. And the Japanese would bomb us, and then we'd bomb them. They'd bomb us, and we'd bomb them. And of course, They just had the smaller bombers. They had what they called a Betsy bomber. They were just a two-engine bomber, and we had these big four-engine bombers. And we, of course, we could carry such a much bigger load of bombs and bigger bombs. They could only carry 100-pound bombs in those Betsy bombers, but the B-24s could carry up to a 500-pound bomb, which mm-hmm. could destroy so much more, you know. And of course, when they'd bomb an island, and they thought it was big enough to run a runway on it with these B-24s, they'd bomb it till they thought they'd killed all the Japanese off of them. And then either the infantry or the Navy, the Marines, the infantry or the Marines, would secure the island. They would go on the island, and they would have troops that go all over the island, and if they could find any Japanese left, they would kill them, you know. And then they'd bring the CBs come in, and they'd build a runway from one side of the island to the other. And then we'd move up to that island, and we'd stay on that island till we could bomb another island. And we went in the Gilbert Islands and Marshall. And while I was on Kwajalein Island, they thought they'd killed all the Japanese there. But they had a dock there, and there was one Japanese hid back in that dock. And on that island, they had pillboxes set up all around that island, but they had little tunnels where they could go from one pillbox to the other all the way around that island.
What's the pillbox?
That was a place where they could get in, and they had a little place where they could look out and point the rifle out, and if they could see any American, they would shoot and kill them, you know.
Just through a slit.
Yeah.
A slit.
And they, on Kwajalein, there was one Japanese, he was back under the, someplace in this dock, and he was in there for, I believe it was almost a month. And then there was another one in one of the pill boxes, and of course, when one of those Japanese would shoot at somebody, then they could pretty well tell where he was coming from, and they finally located both of them, and they killed both of the Japanese. And on this island of Kwajalein, the Japanese had built a headquarters building, and they, on the tops of these buildings, they had little stacks made up where air could go out of the building. And what the Seabees did, they on that island, the Marines secured that island, and they killed all of them. But the officers that was in this headquarters building, and what they did. The Seabees took a bulldozer and covered up the entrance to this building, and then the Marines, they went up on top, climbed up on top of the building, and kicked the tops off of these vents they had up there, and stuck flamethrowers down in there, and killed all the Japanese officers that was in there. And they left them in there for about 30 days. And while they was cleaning up all the other Japanese bodies and getting all of them, and they'd scoop out a big place with a bulldozer, and they'd just dump the Japanese bodies in there, and then they'd cover them up and stick up a sign, 480 Japanese or 500 or whatever it was. And I don't know why they left these officers in this headquarters building so long, but one day they opened them up, and the officers the officers had a place to where they fenced in where they could eat without the flies by them. And I never seen such big green flies in all my life. But when we'd start taking a bite of food, we'd have to flip the green flies off of it to eat the food. And from the smell of the bodies, you know, on that island. But when they opened up that headquarters building and took those bodies out to bury them, I never smelt such an awful odor in all my life. It was so bad that day, we couldn't hardly eat they did that.
You didn't have to open the barracks, you were just on the island. Is that correct?
Yeah, we were on the island, yeah. But this building, the Japanese, they had built this headquarters building, you know. And of course, after they got all the Japanese out of there, they just bulldozed the building down, you know. And, mm-hmm. and then we moved to, I was on the island of Wake, and I believe it was Wake. Anyhow, we went from the Marshall Island, Gilbert Island, and then we went to Guam, the big island of Guam. And when we got to Guam, the runway was out in the middle of the island, and we couldn't hardly believe it. We was on a big island, weren't we? On those little islands where the runway run from one side of the island to the other. And I don't remember which island it was on before we got there. One time, while the flight crew was out on a bombing mission, the Japanese had a dock there, and we went fishing, and we caught enough fish, fresh fish, that we could all the maintenance men and the cooks, we caught enough fish for all of them while the flight crew was all out on the bombing mission. And we really enjoyed that, but the flight crew, they didn't get in on that deal. But anyhow, when we landed on Guam, and every island we was on, they had a battleship with us. And when the Japanese planes would come over, bombing us, they'd try to shoot them down. And occasionally, rather often, they'd shoot a Japanese bomber down when they come over. And when we got on Guam, of course, the Navy, with this battleship, they would have practiced during the day when they wasn't going to have a bomb, Japanese wasn't going to bomb. They'd fly a little plane with a target behind it, and they'd fly at the same speed that these Japanese bombers would fly, and they'd shoot at that target. And they got so good at it, almost every day they'd cut that target off of that plane. Well, when we got on Guam, the big island of Guam, this battleship, of course, is right with us. And they sent over, I believe it was either two or three bombers that night, and they shot down every one of them, the Navy did, with this battleship. Mm-hmm. And they was building a big runway up in the mountains there on Guam, and they were working on it day and night. Of course, if the Japanese come over, why, they just shut down everything, turn off all the lights and everything. And they'd worked on it day and night, except when the Japanese was going to come over and bomb us. And I couldn't wait. I thought, well, I just can't wait till they get that runway finished and see these big B-29s that they're going to bring in here to bomb Tokyo with. Well, they had it almost completed, and they told me that they come around, told me that they was going to send me back. I had signed up for 3 years in the service, you know, and it was then it was over 4 years, and I'd been in the service, and they sent me back, and I didn't get to see them. finish that big runway and bring them big 29s in there to bomb Tokyo with. But they sent me back, and then I was down at Amarillo, Texas for a while, and they first sent me back to Florida down at and they had a place down there where they had a mess hall open day and night, but our food, when we was over there, what we had was dehydrated vegetables and powdered milk, and it was not very appetizing, so we didn't eat very little. But they had a mess hall open day and night down in Florida for us, and my stomach had drawn up to where I couldn't eat no more than a teacup full of food, but they kept us down there for about a month, then sent me, I think it was out to Amarillo, Texas, and Roswell, New Mexico, and while I was down there, they decided to send me to Camp Atterbury and get me out of the service. And the engineering officer came around and he tried to get me to stay in the service, but I was so homesick to get back to Kentucky. I said, no, I want to get back to Kentucky. So he said, well, he said, if you'll stay, he said, I'll jump your rank. I was over there. What happened while we were out in the South Pacific, flying from island to island, I would fly from one island up to another island, and then they'd go on a mission, and they'd come back to that island, and then I'd check the plane over to see whether we go back to our home base island or not. I was supposed to be getting flight pay, but I didn't know that till the flight crew, they after they flew 50 bombing missions in that B-24, then they would send that flight crew back and send in a new crew. Well, when they sent in a new crew in one time, we got to talking about, maintenance crew chiefs flying from one island to the other with the flight crew, and they said, well, when you were in this, if you did the States, you'd be getting flight pay for that. So, and we were all technical sergeants then, so they said, well, we'll jump your rank. So they made us master sergeants. They never did pay us our flight pay, but made us a master sergeant. So anyhow, when I was a master sergeant, when I was down, they was talking about sending me back to, out of the service. And the engineering officer said, if you'll stay, said, we'll jump your rank. And said, all you'll have to do is about 10 o'clock in the morning will be to you go to each one of these hangars and see if they've left any oily rags or any airplane fuel or any grease or anything on the around the planes or any on the planes or around the planes or anything. He said this was about 10 to 12 in the morning, and then he said in the afternoon from about 3 to 5 or something like that, he said, you go check them out again. He said, now that's all you'll have to do if you'll stay here with us. And I said, I want to go back home. so they sent me back to Camp Atterbury, and they mustered me out from Camp Atterbury. And I went back to my home down on Dawson in Montgomery County. And I had a sister that lived in Mount Sterling, and And I came to Mount Sterling, and I stayed with them for a while. And I guess that's about it. Anything else you want to ask me?
Gosh, there's not enough time to ask all the questions. You are a very good storyteller. You're very good.
Well, I wouldn't be here if it wasn't for that guardian angel watching over me so many times.
That's so amazing.
I think about how many times the Japanese dropped bombs on us, and the Lord watched over us. And our bomb shelters on those islands, the Seabees had just scooped out a big place with a bulldozer, and they'd lay a layer of coconut logs across, one layer across, and then they'd lay another layer across the other way, and another layer across the other, like they laid the first layer. And then they'd take and cover that up with sand and coral, and they'd make it a little place just wide enough to where we could go back in that and go back in this bomb shelter. And every time they drop a bomb on the island somewhere, the sand would sift down through us and where we were. But we just thanked the Lord there wasn't a bomb dropped on any of us. But while we were on Johnson Island, the infantry, they dropped a bomb in one of the, there was two fellas, and they did have bomb shelters there. Similar to that, I guess. And they dropped a bomb shelter in one and killed two of the infantrymen while we were there that night. It was there. We was on Johnson Island.
Did you have nurses or medical workers along with you?
The only nurses I saw was one day when I was taking a bath. I don't remember what island we were on, but I was standing out taking the bath. I had a steel helmet and a wash rag, and I was taking the bath, and I heard some women laughing, and I turned around and looked, and here come a Jeep up the runway, and they had nurses in that, and it was kind of embarrassing to me.
Standing there with just your hat in your hands.
Standing there with my just my wash rag. But that was the only nurses I saw.
And it might have been enough.
That was enough. Oh my.
So you came back to Kentucky.
And I came back to Kentucky.
What did you do for a career?
Well, I started in Mount Sterling, down on East Main Street. They had a service station down there, and I started working there at 15 cents an hour. And then I met a woman that was working at the Cowden Manufacturing Company, which is on East High Street, which is not far from where I was. And I met her, this woman, and they had an opening in the shipping. Well, they hadn't been just open very long, and they had an opening in the shipping department. So I went to work there for 25 cents an hour in the shipping department, and I worked there until they built a new building out over the viaduct in Mount Sterling, built a new building, and they moved up there, and I worked in the shipping department up there for almost 5 years. And I found out they had an opening at the post office, and they just got up to 90 cents an hour there at in the Cowden Manufacturing Company. And I heard about this opening down the ship at the post office. So I found out they were paying $1.25 an hour. So I told the boy in the shipping department, I said, "Boys, I'm gonna leave the shipping department and I'm going to the post office." And they said, oh, you can't leave. Said, you're a senior man here in the shipping department. And I said, yes, but I'm going to where I can get $1.25 an hour starting out. And I said, they told me after 90 days, if I worked out all right, then I would go from $1.25 to $1.35 an hour. And I said, I'm just getting 90 cents an hour here. And I said, I'm going. And I said, I'll tell you what I'm going to do. I said, Bill Jackson is in charge of the county manufacturing company here. And I said, he's got something I don't approve of. I said, if he don't like the color of a woman's hair, he'll call her in about 3:45 on Friday afternoon, say, we don't need you no more. Or maybe he don't like the shoes she's wearing, or the dress she's wearing, or something. And I said, I don't like him doing people that way. I said, at 3:45 Friday afternoon, I'm gonna walk in his office and tell him that I am quitting and I'm not gonna work here no more. And he said, oh, you wouldn't do that, would you? I said, you watch and see. I said, but don't tell nobody. I said, you keep it quiet. I don't want you to tell nobody. I want this to be a surprise. And that's just what I did. I kept watching my watch Friday afternoon, and I made sure at 3:45 I was in up there telling them girls I wanted to see Bill Jackson. And they let me in to see Bill Jackson, and I told him that I was quitting, and he looked at me, and he couldn't say anything for a while. Finally he said, what are you gonna do? I said, Monday morning I'm going down to the post office and I'm going to work for $1.25 an hour. And I did.
I'm glad.
And I worked there until December the 31st, 1983.
Oh, gosh.
That year I had 5 heart attacks. And the
five heart attacks.
And the last, on December the 22nd, I about 2:00 in the morning, I was hurting so bad through the center of my chest here. Felt like somebody was pushing something outside of a fence post through my chest. And I was just so weak, I just barely could scratch my wife on the shoulder enough to wake her up. And she turned the light on there beside, on the wall beside the bed. And she said, I looked just about as white as the sheets looked. And she called an ambulance, for an ambulance. And they came. And the fellow driving the ambulance, he came in the bedroom and had the stretcher in the living room. And he just run his arms under me and picked me up and carried me in there and laid me on that stretcher. They put me in the ambulance and took me from Camargo to Mount Sterling. And I remember pulling out on 416 and there in Camargo, this side of Camargo, the big dip in the road. I remember that, about the golf course and somewhere going down over the viaduct. And my wife said, she was riding with me at that time, he could ride with me. She said, what's the matter? And I said, you're standing on my head. And I said, no, I'm going down over there, take me over the viaduct. Well, I'd been carrying the mail all over town, and I couldn't figure out, after I left the going down to the bottom, somewhere between there and the hospital, I never could figure out just where I was. But just before I went out of it, the greatest peace and calm come over me, and I'd wondered what it would be like to die. And I thought, well, this is it. I'm dying. And I didn't remember him even putting me in the hospital at all. I was out of it. And they said they had me in room with another man. And back then they had oxygen tents around the bed. And I was out of it. I didn't know it. But they moved me from there. I don't know how long they had been there, but they moved me down into a private room, the quietest part of the hospital, where they're going to die, because they were sure I was going to die.
Mm-hmm.
And I came to with somebody I know. Well, they was all praying for me. They had to be, or I wouldn't be here. And I opened my eyes, and I looked to my right, and my wife was on the right side of the bed, and I looked to my left. My oldest daughter was there, down the foot of my bed. My youngest daughter was down there. And I couldn't believe it. I closed my eyes, and I opened them again, and I couldn't believe it. I said, well, somebody's prayed, and I'm still here. That was the last part of December, because, and the doctor, I was up there in Mount Sterling Hospital, and the doctor told my wife, he said, I don't know what to do with him. Said, I can't send him home. And said, well, if it was your companion, what would you do? And said, well, I would send him down to Dr. DeBakey down in Texas. Said, world known heart specialist.
Mm-hmm.
And said, well, can you make arrangements? And he said, well, I'll go see.
Mm-hmm.
Well, he came back about an hour and said, I've made arrangements for you to go down there, but said, you have to go right with him. You're going to have to stay right with him. Said, you get somebody to take you all over to Lexington Monday morning.
Mm-hmm.
I believe it was 8 o'clock, then maybe 7 o'clock. Anyhow, I said, and get on the airplane, and you stay right with him now all the way. So they come out with a little two-wheel Julie and had me to back up on it, and they strapped me to that little two-wheel Julie, and they took me up the steps of the plane and rolled me down to my seat and unbuckled me and set me in the seat. Then when we got down to Atlanta, Georgia, we had to change planes. Well, here come with that little Julie again, and they put me on it and buckled me on it and took me off of that plane, and we had to wait, I think, a couple of hours or something. And then they loaded me on another plane and it took us down to Dr. DeBakey down in Texas. And they kept me down there for, I got down there, I think it was the first week of January in 74. Well, they run tests down there for about a week, and one day the Dr. DeBakey came in, sat down on the side of the bed, and he said, Mr. Turley, he said, I said, we're going to operate on you. He said, I believe you can go back to work. I said, well, I had to retire from the post office December 31st. And of course, that's the first week in January 1974. And he said, well, being you're retired, he said, I'll come back and talk to you tomorrow. So he come back the next day and sat down inside the bed there with me and said, well, so Mr. Turley said, I checked your records over, said that these tests we've run, of course they'd been running tests for about a week, and he said, they check out pretty good. He said, look like you've been pretty active. I said, yeah. I've been walking about 12 or 14 miles a day carrying that mail on my left shoulder. And he said, well, he said, Ben, you're retired. He said, I believe if you do what I tell you to do, I believe in a year's time, you'll be feeling pretty good. Said, we won't operate on you. But said, if you have the least bit of trouble, you get on that airplane, you get right back down here, and we'll operate on you. Well, I'd heard them talk about cutting them fellas open and pulled their ribs out here and operating on them, putting them back together, sewing them up with stainless steel bar. And I said, Dr. DeBakey, if you write it down on a piece of paper, I'll do everything you say to do, right to the letter. Well, of course, I'd been over to Lexington in the Veterans Hospital, too, one time while I had a heart attack. And every doctor I went to, the first question was, they asked me, said, do you smoke? And I said, no. They said, have you ever smoked? I said, yes. Said, how long has it been since you smoked? I said, been about 20 years. They said, well, that's in your favor. So you drink any alcohol beverage? And I said, no. Said, how long has it been? That's been about 20 years. Well, that's in your favor. So you drink any coffee? And regular coffee? I said, oh, I love coffee. Don't drink no more. Nothing with caffeine in it. I said, okay. And said, don't drink anything ice cold. Drink at room temperature. Don't eat any more ham, no more pork, no more eggs, no more salt. And he had a whole list of things for me to do. No more running, and no more pushing on an automobile or lifting on a refrigerator or anything heavy. And he said, if it's been as, don't go up steps two at a time anymore, like you've been doing. Of course, he knew I'd been carrying the mail.
Uh-huh.
And he said, if there's been as five steps, you start and walk at an angle. If it's more than five steps, you turn and walk at an angle. Don't go straight up them steps if it's been as five steps. And no more eating after 6 o'clock at night. And
so you did this stuff, obviously.
He had a whole,
you're still
whole
here.
List of things for me to do, you know. And he said, I believe in years' time you'd be feeling pretty good. But said, now the main thing is, when you get tired, you sit down and rest. And he said, now there'll be some time when you don't feel like doing anything. He said, don't do anything.
Mm-hmm.
As soon as you get rested up, you start moving around and do something. But said, watch what you're doing now. Be real careful. And I said, I will. I did what he told me to do. And
you're still here to tell the stories today.
And I'm still here today.
That's great.
Still here today, yeah.
Well, I'm really glad that you decided to come in. It's been a real pleasure to sit and listen to you for an hour. Can you believe it's been an hour?
Really?
Yeah.
I can't believe it's been an hour.
It's been a very enjoyable hour for me.
But I didn't tell you about when I got married.
Mm-hmm.
And I married this beautiful woman, the prettiest woman in the world, I thought, in Wichita. We started going, about 2 years after we got married, we started going to church. Church of God on North Queen Street there in Mount Thurman. And we got saved and started living for the Lord. And about 3 months after we got saved, one night she said, honey, said, do you love anybody more than me? And I thought for just a little bit, and I said, yes. Well, she started bawling and crying. And I thought I'd never get her hush from crying. And she said, I thought you loved me more than anybody in this world. And I said, well, honey, I tell you what. I love the Lord first. And I said, I'm going to put him first. You're going to come second. And the children's going to come third. And I said, honey, if I can keep things in that order, the Lord first, you second, and the children third, you won't have to worry about this old boy being faithful and true to you. You won't have to worry about me being mistreating you in any way at all. I'll do everything I can to make you happy and to please you if I can keep the Lord first all the time. And we've been married 61 years.
Oh my goodness.
And I've never said a bad word before her or the children. And we have never been in an argument. I've got 20 some hats. And a lot of them hanging over the back door. And there's been a few times when I'd put on a hat and go be out and come back about an hour or so. And if things was all right, well, I'd stay, take my hat off and stay. But to this day, we've never had an argument. And the children have never heard me say a bad word.
Yeah.
Or anything at all. And we have had a wonderful life.
Well-rounded life.
And about about 3 years ago. Of course, we go to church Sunday morning, Sunday night, and Wednesday night. And on Wednesday night, we have prayer meeting and we have Bible study. We study a chapter in the Bible. And on one Wednesday night, about it's been about three years ago at least, we both felt real bad all day long. And she said, "Are you going to church?" I said. She said, "I feel too bad to go." I said, "I don't feel like going." I said, "But the closer it got time to go to church, I said, I hate to miss Bible study." And I told her, I said, "But honey, I'm going on to church." I said, "I can feel bad at church just as well as I feel bad at home." Mm-hmm. So I got an automobile and I went on to church. I sit up close to the front of the church anyhow. And I felt bad all during the service. Just when service just was ending, my body got so weak and my face, head dropped down on my chest. And I was so weak I couldn't even raise my head up. And I looked down at my hands and I lost the color, looked like a dead person. It just so happened these two guardian angels sitting behind me, two women, and they tapped me on the shoulder about the same time. They said, "Brother Turley, are you sick?" And I said, "Yeah." They said, "You want to go pray?" And I said, "Yes." And they helped me up there and they set me on that altar rail. And I was so near gone, I didn't hear anybody pray.
Really?
All I heard was, I don't know how many, several gathered around. Somebody said, "Amen, amen, amen, amen." Mm-hmm. Each time somebody said, "Amen," life come back to my body.
Huh.
I raised my head up, my strength, looked down there, my color had come back.
Yeah.
And I stood up, and the pastor said, "Brother Turner," said, "give me them car keys, I'm gonna drive you home." I said, "Well, you can drive me home, ain't nothing on me." He said, "Give me them car keys." I said, "Well, I won't argue with the preacher here."
That's right. Another story.
Okay.
I'm gonna stop this now because I'm getting, the lights are coming on and off in there. And I'm so glad that you participated.